looked at him with such awe and uncertainty, her eyes ignited by the moon. He had whispered her name, and looked into those eyes, such eyes, all darkness, promising a thousand secrets. He still dreamed of that first night they had spent together. "Oh, all I did was put you in touch," George said gently. "I would have been a poor brother if I had watched her waste away. All she wanted, from the moment she laid eyes on you, was to be your wife." This made Isaac rather warm under the collar. The only thing he had never given Marigold was a proposal. It was not to be. It never could be. She was too far below him. An orphaned scullery maid, born to an officer of the East India Company and his Indian mistress. George was all that was left of her English family, and he was so poor now that he could not support her. Only the compassion of people he had helped had kept him off the streets. All he could afford was some squalid garret on Earlham Street. How unjust that such a kind fellow should live in such a wretched state. Isaac rested his brow against the window. His mother wanted him to marry Anne Crowley, who came with a large dowry and a respectable name. But even if he married her, he knew he would not be able to let go of Marigold. She was all gentleness and innocence, and she knew when to be silent. Anne was handsome, but too cold and too forthright. If only the Earl Queen had taken her instead. The cab stopped when the woods were in sight. George banged on the roof.
"Drive on, man. What's the matter?"
"I shan't go any farther, sir," the driver said. "The Earl Queen will see us."
"Oh, the devil take you." George clicked his tongue. "Come along, Ice. No time to lose."
They took leave of the cab. Isaac paid the driver £1, over twice what he was owed. He could earn far more if he sold the story of the eligible Isaac Fairfax breaking the law. But they would have to hope that he was a half-wit. The woods were clad in bonfire gold and red, yet the colors were somehow cold, hollow and illusory, like rich clothes left to rot on corpses. Isaac had the sense that looking at them was what it must be like to be lost in opium, seeing things that were not quite there.
"Isaac," George said, "remember what I told you. Don't follow the music. Ignore any peculiar lights or sounds."
He placed a hand on the pistol at his side. "The Earl Queen steals little girls. She won't be ready for men now, will she?" Isaac nodded.
"God be with us, George."
A wry smile curved George's mouth. "God does not walk in the forest of Earl." Together, the two men stepped toward the trees. As they crossed the boundary, a dark fog gathered around them and thickened in their throats. Isaac turned cold to his soul, but he pressed on. Marigold was waiting for them. When a man entered any wooded place in England, he passed into one great forest of Earl. So the tales claimed, in any case. Only Princess Alice had ever returned from the Earl Queen's realm, and she had said nothing about her imprisonment. This forest existed in a kind of spirit country of its own, and if he wandered too far into it, he would never find the way back out. If he was fortunate enough to emerge, he might find himself somewhere miles away from the place where he had entered. One could make the crossing in Hampshire and stumble out in Galloway. When the fog cleared, Isaac shuddered. A bitter wind slashed at his face, unnerving him before it stopped abruptly, as if the wind were the breath of the forest and its mouth had locked closed. They stood on fallen leaves in a silence so deep it was almost too much to bear. Their boots sank to their ankles. George hefted up the lantern he was carrying. Every footstep crackled, scraping at Isaac's nerves, and when he stepped on a hidden twig, it let out a sound like a gunshot that echoed through the forest. Sweat trickled from his hairline. He was certain he could see green eyes among the foliage. "I see no yews," he murmured. The trees, whatever sort they were impossibly tall. Even their lowest branches were higher than Isaac could have reached, even if he had thrown a stone. At first glance, it was an ordinary forest, aside from the colossal trees. But when his vision sharpened, he found the imperfections. The trunks bled golden sap. The cracks in the bark glowed lambent red. He saw that the forest was only a mask, and the poison beneath, the poison of the Earl Queen, was oozing through the fractures. Everything was washed in a queasy greenish light, and it all seemed to curve, as if he were peering through a glass bottle. Or all of it was a picture printed on a newspaper, and he was pulling its edges toward him, warping it strangely. It made him giddy and breathless and frightened all at once. He had only taken a few steps, and already he was disoriented, as if he had taken the whole bottle of brandy. George wavered too. His path had been straight at first, but now he veered to and fro, making the lantern sway. Watching it made Isaac feel as if he might be sick. "She must know now," he whispered. "She must know of our coming, George."
"She knows."
Isaac turned on his heel, drawing his sword. The voice had been so close to his ear that he had felt breath fluttering there, and it did not belong to George. But no one was behind him. A shadow scuttled in the corner of his eye, and a titter, high and childlike, sent a cold draft down his nape. He spun to face it with a hoarse cry, just in time to see a ribbon of scarlet disappearing behind a tree.
"What is it?" George hissed. "Isaac?"
Sprites. They had come already. Their blood-red hair was famous. What Alice had followed into the woods, a lesser sort of Earl folk, but no less dangerous. They would be carrying word of the stranger's presence to their queen.
"I heard," his tongue was clumsy, "a voice."
"The voice of a son, a servant, a sentinel."
This time, George also flinched. His eyes reflected the lantern. All around them, dead leaves shifted and danced, resurrected from their grave. They reeled into a churning column. It moved the way a dancer would cross Pandemonium's ballroom, and it flickered with the vestige of the autumnal red. Dizzied by the sight of it, and frightened half to death, Isaac tightened his hold on the sword. As he watched, the column gained sharp edges and corners, firmed, and whirled itself into the shape of a man, pale, barefoot, and almost naked. All that protected his modesty were frayed breeches, palest silver-green and coated with fine hair. More flaxen hair poured over his shoulders in abundance and streamed to his waist, clinging to his skin as if he had risen from water. His entire body was knotted and gnarled with muscle.
"Men,"
this formidable creature observed.
"Human men in the forest of Earl."
The pointed ears marked him as an Earl, but the black eyes were the true seal of his heritage. Maggot holes into oblivion. This could only be the Earl Queen's son. Isaac thrust his sword forward, gripping it in a white-knuckled hand. He had seen the fanciful illustrations of elves in Punch, but he had never felt such terror as he did when he beheld their prince with his own eyes. No drawing could capture the way the creature bled the warmth from the air around them, the sense that he was more element than being, the certainty that he had no business taking the form of a man. He had been here since the world was new. All this Isaac knew from only a glance.
"We have come for Marigold Beef,"
Isaac said. His hand shook. Tell us where you took her. Don't speak to it, Isaac. George's pistol was aimed between those ghastly eyes. It has no power over metal. Is that so, man of flesh? The Earl Queen's son purred. People will believe almost anything if they hear it in a coffee house. If rumor has it, then it must be true. Do you believe everything you hear about Earl folk, Isaac Fairfax? He took a step toward them. Do you believe everything you hear about me? The eyes were on him now, penetrating his soul. Isaac swallowed the sour taste that was rising in his gorge. When he looked into those eyes, he saw a world without order. He saw the chaos of prehistory. Despite what the gossips had whispered, he could not imagine this thing in the brothels of Covent Garden. Tell us, his mouth was so dry. Tell us where you took Marigold, damn you. Marigold Beef is safe, was the calm rejoinder, just as Princess Alice was. How cruel of you it was to take Alice away. She left without injury, but Marigold is older. She has tasted our food and sipped our honey. If she leaves the forest, she will die. Lies, George sneered. You bewitched the princess, and you stole my sister. Take us to her at once, or I will help the Earl Queen understand how it feels to lose a member of one's family. The Earl Queen's son tilted his head. Oh my, do you mean to break your own queen's law? The laws of England have never helped me, neither have they helped my sister. George locked gazes with the fiend. Marigold needs her brother. Or does her brother need her? George Beef. Isaac stared. There was one thing the gossips had painted with some accuracy. The smile of thorns. It was as if the stem of a rose had been stripped and each thorn pressed into coal-black gum. A red tongue licked over them. She will not be pleased that you have come for her, the Earl Prince said. She does not speak well of you, gentlemen. Not at all. How did the Earl Queen know of them already? Surely even sprites weren't that quick on their feet. Isaac tried to find his voice. He was ready to plead for Marigold's life, to fall to his knees and beg, but George's patience snapped violently. Isaac cried, "No!" an instant too late. The bullet pierced the Earl Queen's son where a man's heart should be. He looked down at his chest with a sort of curiosity. "Oh, England," he said, "when will you learn?" He crumbled into nothing. Isaac threw himself upon the heap of leaves. "George," he choked out, "he might have led us to Marigold. Why in God's name did you shoot him?" "He would have lured us into a trap," George said curtly. "You saw his mouth. They speak of roses without thorns, but elves are roses without blooms. You killed her son, their prince." He hunted desperately through the leaves. "If this forces open war, oh, for goodness sake, we are already at war, Isaac. My poor sister is a prisoner of it." George kept his pistol close. "On your feet, now. Help me find a ewe." Isaac's hands fell limp. "Yes, a ewe." He had almost forgotten that they were looking for one. Yes, they must find a ewe and tear the bark from it, and the sprites would return and lead them to the Earl Queen. George extended his free hand. Isaac took it. Once he was upright, he used his cuff to smear away the sweat from his upper lip, tasting salt and fear. The leaves did not stir again. He could not consider the repercussions now. If he could come out of this with Marigold in his arms and her gratitude to him, even treason
would be a small thing. Yew. Yes, he knew what a yew tree looked like. He had seen them often enough as a boy in Surrey. He followed George farther into the gloom, staggering a little. When he looked over his shoulder, he could still make out the grass beyond the trees and the light of the hansom cab beyond, but that light was ebbing. "George," he said, "ought we to leave a trail?" "No, no. Once the Earl Queen is dead, her hold on the forest will be released." "You know this for certain?" "Nothing is known for certain about the elves." "This," George said, "is intuition, and I trust mine implicitly. I trusted that you would love Marigold as fervently as she loved you, and was that not true? I trusted that you would one day make her a good husband, and I know that you will prove me right." He stepped over a root. "You must ask her after this, Isaac. You must marry her." "This hardly seems the time for talk of marriage, George. You have delayed for too long. Marigold's reputation will be in jeopardy by now." Isaac had no room for these thoughts. Her reputation? For some absurd reason, he chuckled. The forest was addling his wits. "She was sent by royal decree, George. Surely nobody could question. Her honor was never in peril before, while I was there to protect you both. But she has been with the Earl folk for 3 days," George said, shooting him a doleful look. "Unchaperoned, unprotected. You saw that creature, how bestial it was. Marigold would never..." "Of course not, Ice, but London is a nest of gossips and busybodies. They will wonder how any woman's virtue could survive in the company of such wildness. No one else will have her." It was, as George was saying this, in his earnest tone that Isaac heard the music. At first it was gentle, almost imperceptible, but it soon engulfed his hearing. "Do you hear that?" he asked. But George had already pressed ahead, taking the lantern with him. Isaac turned, drunkenly. "He called us cruel," he murmured to no one in particular, "for taking Princess Alice away." A light flared in the forest, blue and pulsing. He followed the song toward it without care, forgetting about George, about Marigold, about the Earl Queen's son. Every fairy tale warned of the voices of the elves, of stone circles concealed in grass that ensnared whatever stepped inside them. But although Isaac knew this, the knowledge was distant, so it hardly seemed like it mattered at all. The forest was safe. And there was something miraculous waiting for him where the blue light shone. Something that would put an end to his anguish. All he needed to do was go to it. Soon he was following a stream, where iridescent fish were swimming. Their teeth were needles jutting out of their turned-down mouths. He waded in and cupped his hands, saw his own image in the water. The same face he had seen in the glass, but happier, with bloodshot eyes. He blinked, and he was standing before the mouth of a cave. Giddy, he lurched into it, his gloved hands rasped against stone. He breathed in an ambrosial scent. "Isaac," someone was calling. "Isaac." The wind itself was whispering his name. "Marigold," he said. "Isaac." He forced his body through the cave, scrabbling at its walls, splashing through the stream. Blind and deaf, he dashed his head against a low rock, but the pain was washed away by the realization that Marigold was close. He would have her back. She would be his to love again. When he emerged, he shielded his eyes. Light was streaming from above him, glorious sunlight, softened to amber where it fell through a canopy of ochre leaves. Birds were chirruping from low branches, which were laden with rainbows of fruit. Had it not been night-time on the other side? He was standing in a sheltered glade, an Elysium in the depths of the forest, and all around him there were women and girls. A child with golden ringlets was laughing on the grass, her cheeks and brow flecked by the sunlight. Older girls, no more than 14, were fishing with spears. Others were dancing or picking fruit or making chains of wildflowers. One woman had a prune for a face and silver hair, and she held a newborn baby in her arms. They wore simple clothes. Many wore trousers, like men, or had their skirts bound up around their knees, while others were clad in dresses that looked for all the world like they were made of butterflies. He had never seen so many girls together without a chaperone. Was it a mirage? He was drunk on the cloying scent of flowers, and at the end of the stream, where water pooled deep and clear beside a waterfall, was a woman with hair that shone like the finest lacquer. She wore a gown of emerald green silk, hitched up to bare her slim brown calves. She poured water over her hair from a jug, renewing its luster. Her head was tilted into the sunlight, and her eyes were closed. He could have stared at her forever. So peaceful did she look. Marigold, he breathed, because he could not bear to be silent. Then louder. Marigold. Her head flicked to face him. Her eyes grew wide, and Isaac's face broke into a smile. She was alive. He should admonish her for dressing so improperly, but instead he ran toward his treasure, arms outstretched to grasp her. She screamed. Isaac stopped dead. Marigold scrambled away from him, slinking down the rock until she was knee-deep in the water.
No, no,
she said. To the girls she shouted,
Fetch the Earl Queen! Why on earth did none of you stop them?
The children in the glade sprang to their feet.
Mother,
they chorused.
Mother, help Marigold!
The plea was taken up all around them until it echoed like a cry into the mouth of a bell. Isaac hardly noticed. All he could do was gaze at Marigold, and it seemed all she could do was gaze back. But there was nothing familiar left in her eyes. He looked upon a changeling.
"Leave me, Isaac Fairfax," she said in a tremulous voice. Her skirts drifted on the surface of the water. "Let me go."
"Marigold, you are bewitched," he held out his hand.
"The Earl Queen stole you. I can take you back."
"Back to what?" Marigold shook her head.
"Back to a life as a scullery maid, rented for profit?"
She sank deeper into the water.
"She says he'll murder me. George, he's always longed to do it, you know. If I return to that world, I am not long for it. I pitied you once. You were deceived, but I cannot forgive you. I cannot forgive you for not seeing through George's lie."
She had never spoken like this to him. The quake had left her voice. Now she sounded so cold, so hardened.
"Lie," he repeated. "Marigold, what on earth do you mean? Nobody rented you. Look to George. Look to your own heart. Did you never realize that when I wept because I was afraid, not happy?"
She crossed her arms over herself as if to shield her heart. It made her look so young, so fragile, so like his Marigold.
"I know now. I know that I am whole, that I am strong, and I am free to make my life what I will. You will not take me as Queen Victoria took Alice, as my father took me from my mother."
"Marigold, enough of this." She must be addled by the Earl Queen's feast, but he was beginning to feel angry. All this way he had come for her, and all she could do was call her own brother murderous and talk about the mother she had never known.
"You are confused, my love. You are not yourself."
She raised her chin.
I believe I am best placed to decide what I am. I am more myself than I ever was. You were perfect before. His throat was full. You are perfect, Marigold. No, I was compliant, she said bitterly, because that was what you wanted. He knew what you wanted, Isaac. My brother knows you like your women, to be soft-spoken, to flatter you and simper for you. Her hand struck through the water in frustration. Isaac flinched. He blackmailed me. He saw me as his ruin, his mother's death. In my cradle, I was poison to his name, and he meant me to pay for it. To pay my debt by marrying you, even if I had to spend the rest of my days in misery. He cared nothing for my happiness, only his reputation. Her face was contorted. Oh, Isaac, do you still not see? Tears were in her eyes. Her teeth were bared in anger. Leaves were shifting in the glade. The children emptied baskets of them, carpeting the grass. This could not be Marigold. He was using both of us, Isaac, she spat. He told me he would kill me the first time if I refused to do what you wanted. And after, he promised he would ruin me if I was not the perfect mistress. He would tell the synods we met, allow them to find us. He was the one who arranged our meetings, wasn't he? He always knew where we were. Marigold rose from the water. Rivulets streamed from her hair, soaking her sleeves. He befriended you because he thought you were weak-willed. My brother has a silver tongue. If you married me, if you could be persuaded in the end to marry me, he believed the Beath family would be raised to its former glory, that he would no longer be in destitution. She shook her head. I was never yours. I do not love you. I never did. If you care for me at all, leave me. Isaac was close to choking. I cannot leave you. He could not understand, would not understand. George told me. He told me you loved me, that you wanted to see me. A scullery maid in a household you had never visited. When did I become besotted with you? You saw me through the window. Now she looked pitying. Do you really suppose that one can fall in love with a person through a window? He could not stand this. He couldn't look at her, knowing she would flee from him if he tried to take her in his arms again. Marigold, come here. Isaac was jolted from his memories. George had come into the glade. The children fled from him, crying for their mother. George, he said faintly. Marigold, George said, ignoring him, you will stop making a fool of yourself and step out of the water. Come with us at once. Marigold stumbled deeper into the pool, so the water came past her waist. No, George, she said, eyes flashing. I have had enough of your threats, your scheming. George clicked his tongue. You see, Isaac, bewitched, just as I said. He strode toward her. She looked half wild with fear. Marigold, I don't want to have to hurt you. Leave me be. Isaac cringed at her shrill tone. This was not her voice, not Marigold. George was right. You are becoming hysterical, sister. George was always so calm, so unruffled. He fixed her with an unblinking stare, the sort one would use on a deer before shooting it. Marigold, Isaac has given me his word that he will marry you when you return to England. You see? You will be Marigold Fairfax, a respectable lady of London, with a husband who adores you. Your reputation will not be ruined, and our family name will be restored. You'll see. But Isaac had never promised to marry her. George must know that it was impossible. He must always have known that Isaac was meant to court Anne, surely, yet he spoke of the possibility so often. Reputation, Marigold laughed. Our father used my mother to slake his desire, stole her newborn child, and left her to rot. And she was not the only woman to suffer that fate. Tears glossed her eyes for a fleeting instant before they turned to flint again. You used me to get what you wanted. So did Isaac. Yet it is my reputation in peril. Do you truly wonder why I want to stay here? George's pistol pointed at her heart. George, Isaac cried. How dare you threaten her? Don't be a milksop. I will shoot her if it saves her life, his friend snapped. A decent surgeon will take out the bullet. She'll only have a little scar. Shoot me, then, Marigold said, before Isaac could protest. Shoot me, like an honorable man. She held out her hands. He'll kill me either way, Isaac. The Earl Queen knows the future. If you let him take me back, he will strangle me before I turn 17. He will tell you that I ran away to find my mother, that I drowned at sea, anything to make you forget. No one will know the truth. His heart was breaking. He was a statue, struck too hard by a chisel, splintering all over. His eyes grew hot and damp. George claimed he had done it all for her, so she might have a chance of love with a man above her station. Could his dear friend really have been little more than a procurer, a parasite with designs upon the Fairfax fortune? Had George truly believed Isaac would make Marigold his bride, even if it meant lowering his own reputation? It was more than he could bear, and he could not believe it of George, his friend. Wind murmured around them, carrying leaves with it. The light vanished from overhead, turning the mist the stern gray of pewter. Isaac felt a chill on his neck. A woman had appeared in the center of the glade. Earth cracked from her shoulders as she rose to her full height. Her skin was the darkest bark, her hair was a wreath of ivy, and she wore nothing but a veil of gossamer. Inside her face, just visible through it, were the same black eyes she shared with the prince. For this could be none other than the Earl Queen, other Queen of England, the creature who had stolen all these girls from those who loved them, the creature who had terrorized a country. "Leave," she said in a soughing voice. Isaac unsheathed his sword again. It had been easy to kill the Earl Queen's son. Now he was not so afraid. "Not without the girl," George said. "Release my sister from your bewitchment, or I will shoot you as I shot your hell-spawned offspring." Victoria made a bargain, a life for a life. The forest rippled as she approached, half-walking and half-drifting, like a wraith from a nightmare. "Leave!" Marigold splashed through the water and ran toward the monster. George grabbed her and pulled her, writhing against him. He pressed the pistol to his sister's jaw, and she began to cry out, a hoarse, enraged sound. Her breast heaved as the Earl Queen watched them, her face betraying nothing through the veil.
"Isaac," Marigold gasped. "Isaac, you must see what he is."
"Quiet." George only had eyes for the Earl Queen. "You will stand aside and let us leave."
"If she leaves," the Earl Queen whispered, "she dies young."
Isaac swallowed. "And Princess Alice?" When the Earl Queen turned to look at him, the forest seemed to move with her. Leaves and petals clung to her veil. The birds warbled a frenzy of song. The wind sighed. He almost lost courage, but he said, "Will the princess also die young?"
"Her wedding will be held in the shadow of death. She will be melancholy all her life, and will not outlive her mother. Two of her children will be slain," the Earl Queen said. "Two more will die before they truly lived. She was happy in the Forest of Earl."
"She protects us, Isaac," Marigold said, her voice low and strained. "The Earl Queen protects us from being hurt, being killed. She brings us here to save us from our fates, to give us a happy life. She is kind to us. She saw in the pool that George would..."
"Riddles and blasphemy!"
George gripped her arm. "Back to London we go, my dear. Isaac, with me." His face was almost bloodless. "We must get Marigold away from here. She needs protection from a man, not this monster." Isaac hesitated. He ought to listen to Marigold. He thought he had loved her, but he had loved a facade. Whatever might or might not be true of George, he was her blood and a shrewd man. He knew what was best for her. And to leave her with this hellish thing that had worked such an enchantment on her mind was surely to leave her for dead. "No, Marigold," he said thickly. "I want you too much." She closed her eyes and turned her face away. That was when the Earl Queen's son appeared beside his mother. As Isaac beheld the creature he was certain they had killed, he turned cold to his very soul.
"If we Earl folk had any weaknesses, we would take care for humans not to know them."
The Mouth of Thorns smiled at them both.
"I did ask you, Isaac Fairfax," it said, "if you believed everything you heard about me. You believed that girls were easily distracted. You believed I could be slaughtered with metal."
Steel had never harmed them. It had been a lie, all of it, baseless gossip, London whispers. They had no weapons, no means by which to guarantee their safe passage. As Isaac realized how grave a mistake they had made, George ran, hauling Marigold with him by the hair. She screamed at him in fury. In his wake, Isaac desperately swung his sword at the Earl Queen's son, shouting, "Get back, villain!" No longer knowing whether he was fighting to reach Marigold or to protect George, or simply to preserve his own life. But when he slashed open that glistening skin, all that came out were sap and flies, thousands of flies. He screamed as they surrounded him, as they infested him. The last thing he saw were the rose thorn teeth. It must have been hours later when he woke. George was nowhere to be seen. Isaac's sword lay dull and stained among the leaves, too far away to grasp. The Earl Queen and her son stood over him, bloodied mouths, glinting black eyes. Oh, those teeth, those terrible teeth, red with death.
"Do not weep, Isaac Fairfax," the Earl Queen said softly. "This story has a happy ending. Marigold is safe at last from the monsters who imprisoned her."
A whimper was the only sound that passed his lips. He could not move. He could not speak. He could not scream as the forest drank him into its embrace. Somewhere in the dancing shadows, Marigold was singing, and darkness was encroaching on the glade. Regan Peruse's Villain Challenge to Samantha Shannon. Earl Queen Retelling in 19th Century London. Evil Revealed by Regan Peruse. Folklore is awesome because, historically, it is both a tool for entertainment and for warning against dangers, both natural and human-made. Societal expectations of behavior are woven into these fantastical stories, and they are used as guides to explain what is right and what is wrong. Within the realm of folklore, the Earl Queen fascinated me the most. Originating in Scandinavian folklore, she is a fairy queen who lives deep in the forest, where she lures young children and kidnaps them. She is a villain,
created to scare young children from straying too far from home, and also a story to scare society about women who seek too much power, or any power at all. Because while the Earl Queen is evil, she is also inherently a very formidable, badass, independent woman. Enter Samantha Shannon's Marigold. Marigold, a.k.a. Victorian England's most desirable bachelorette. Why? Why did it have to be her? How had Marigold caught the eye of the Earl Queen? She was quiet as a doll, and delicate too, more of a household spirit than a living girl. Samantha turns this maiden-in-a-tower trope on its head when it's revealed that the saviors are, in fact, Marigold's captors. Men, if they desired, had the power to not only control, but also destroy every aspect of a woman's life in Victorian society. This twist also showed how easily a woman's desires are dismissed without a thought. George being the absolute worst person on the planet. "Riddles and blasphemy," George gripped her arm. "Back to London we go, my dear. Isaac, with me." His face was almost bloodless. "We must get Marigold away from here. She needs protection from a man, not this monster." Marigold did not want to be saved. The Earl Queen's reign was not a prison, but a sanctuary. For the first time in her existence, Marigold could make her own choices regarding her happiness, and she would do anything to not have to forfeit that to anyone. Marigold killing it, both literally and metaphorically. A whimper was the only sound that passed his lips. He could not move, he could not speak, he could not scream as the forest drank him into its embrace. Somewhere in the dancing shadows, Marigold was singing. Marigold and the Earl Queen show women taking power back in their own hands and ultimately shattering the notion of female fragility and meekness with a hammer. Oh man, was it an interesting contrast to place this powerful woman in 19th century England. Did you know that Victorian England was one of the most visibly conservative times for women in Western history? Women were not only oppressed politically and socially, but in many ways physically as well. They were confined to their separate sphere, deemed only able to exist to rear children and to balance out the moral taint that their husbands produced in the outside world. They were the moral light to civilization, too weak for work, and surely too weak for evil. All this historical baggage came to a head wonderfully in Samantha's story, which makes the reader confront the ambiguity of evil head on. Two men set out, determined to save this poor girl from the grasp of the evil Earl Queen, only to have the tables turned on them. And the reader, evil in many cases, is a matter of perspective, and society tends to villainize things they don't understand, such as female independence. Sometimes true evil isn't understood until it's too late, but sometimes, if we're lucky, it is immortalized as a lesson for others. Folklore is funny that way.
You, it's all about you. By Adam Silvera. You've made a name for yourself, and no one remembers the old one. You threw away your birth name because an 18-year-old building a reputation as a respectable crime lord was difficult enough without being held back by the name Amanda. For the past 4 months, you've gone by Slate, the dealer of the finest memory drugs. You're worshipped for the way days can make the city forget. You're celebrated for the way Token can revive memories as far back as childhood. You're feared for the way trance can implant false stories others forge. Your reputation is godly, but precautions such as your mask are still to be taken. Hiding doesn't bother you. If believers never see God's face, why should they see yours? These days, unfortunately, you're a god who has to get her hands dirty. You shouldn't be out here at the dock for this deal. Neither should Carl, who's parked a couple of blocks north to take you home once this transaction is done. But your last assistant, some clown who was twice your age, thought it would be funny to sell your drugs at half price and skip town. He certainly wasn't laughing when you tracked him down, brought him back, and force-fed him an entire bottle of Days until he could only remember 6 select words. Now he spends his days and nights walking the streets and uttering your warning to anyone passing him. Slate is not to be betrayed. You let him live, but you took his life. Fair trade. You walk to the edge of the dock, the stink of floating trash overpowering the rotted flesh that makes up your mask. You stare at the decapitated Statue of Liberty beneath the moon, finding it oddly beautiful. You expected destruction like this after little gangbangers working for Pierce started spiking people's drinks with his new bronze serum last month, but you didn't think the steroids were so charged that it'd make the users psychotic enough to scale up the statue and pound away at its face with their fists until it crumbled onto the island. Thankfully, Lady Liberty got the last laugh when she took those bastards down with her, crushing them. Footsteps cautiously approach you. You know your client is on time without checking your watch. No one gets a second chance at an appointment with you, the most wanted girl in the city. The cops want you and the junkies want you. You're more wanted than Pierce and his super strength serum. You're more wanted than Local and his tracking bugs, which are so reliable that even cops are illegally using them. But no one wants you dead or locked up in prison more than Franklin Ladeau, the young scientist undoing all your work with his retrieve vaccine. You took care of that. Now you're wanted most by Carl, thankfully. You need this one good connection in this life of masks that makes you want to be yourself. Are you her? You turn around and answer with your mask. The client is supposed to be 18. But he looks to be in his early 20s instead. Heartbreak can age a person. He's 6 feet, a little taller than you, but you knew to expect this. You stalked him online to see if there was actually a chance he had enough money to pay for your most illegal drug. Turns out his father launched a successful new app for college students looking to date. The irony of this meeting doesn't surprise you. He avoids your face, backing away, the gym bag in his hand trailing along the ground. It's not news to you that you look like you're attending the creepiest masquerade ever. What would be news to the world is how the rotted flesh pulled across your face once belonged to your father's hand. The bones of his fingers, entwined by rope, keep the mask tight across dozens of tiny scars he inflicted upon you. But that story isn't anyone's business but your own. Not even Carl knows about this. "You're her," he says. The certainty in his voice is rewarding, considering how many posers are out there pretending they're you. You're as unmistakable as your product is unrivaled. "I'm Mike," he says. You know. You know his name, and you know why he's here. You reach into your jacket pocket, and your fingers brush against the small pistol while grabbing the drugs. "It's 8,000 for Trance. You've never killed before, but if he tries haggling on this evening when you're desperate to get back home for some normalcy with Carl, this boy will have a third eye before he even realizes you've grabbed your only-for-absolute-emergencies gun. He tries handing over his gym bag, but you hold up your hand and he halts. You point to the backpack leaning against a grimy crane that's missing a wheel. "Put the money in there," you say. The aluminum inside the backpack will interfere with any signals in the event Mike was recruited by Local to bug you. The price on your head for being the most wanted girl in the city is huge. You should start increasing your rates for how risky this is becoming. Mike kneels between the bags, shuffling cash from one to the next. If there's even $1 missing, you'll put him through a pain he won't be able to forget, even with a strong dose of Days.
"I need my girlfriend back," Mike says, looking up at you as if this is a surprise.
Even if you hadn't stalked him online to see his recent relationship status switch from in a relationship to single, you'd know what was up. Love is the reason Trance is such a top seller.
She found out I was cheating on her. It was a mistake, seriously. I'll never do it again. We just need a fresh start.
You hate hearing the stories. You didn't care about the woman who needed days to forget the sins against her sister and start anew. You didn't care about the man who needed Token to remember his dead stepfather more vividly. You didn't care about the man who needed Trance to trick his boss into giving him a promotion he didn't deserve. You don't care about this kid needing days to get his girlfriend back. But you listen, because a god is only a god when they know how to serve their worshippers.
Days will work, right?
Your doubts are not my problem. My reputation has gotten you this far. This is why the cops and bounty hunters want you so badly. The authorities don't care as much about people forgetting their own drama or taking a stroll down memory lane. They care when Days, Trance, and Token are used against others. The authorities are too caught up in locking you away to see the good of what you do. How some takers are better off. Some were nobodies off the streets. Others needed escapes from abusive situations, new identities. But they don't see that. They chase you down because they think what you're doing is unethical. Except you don't force this on anyone. Not anyone who doesn't deserve it, at least. Mike finishes depositing all the cash into your bag and looks up at you. You toss him the drugs, which he catches with shaky hands. He stares at the small velvet pouch containing the 4 days' seeds.
How should I...
Your move, not mine, you say. You only supply the seeds. It's up to them to plant it. You're betting on him bowing out of this completely. You doubt his desperation. You also care so little, you're already thinking about putting his father's $8,000 toward a yacht for you and Carl. Mike stares at the pouch with a loser's smile.
Who said you can't buy happiness, eh?
You roll your eyes. He takes a couple of steps toward you, and the gun is out of your pocket so fast the smile is still on his face. But he doesn't beg for his life.
You're an angel, he says.
Even as he looks upon your face, masked with flesh so rotten it's gone charcoal black, he calls you an angel. This is a first. You've been called a god for your power, and you've been called the devil for your fierceness, but you've never been called an angel for your services. Mike looks as if he wants to bow before you and kiss your feet, but instead he turns away from you and the gun you're pointing at him. An angel. Interesting.
Put the gun down!
This new voice rips you out of your reverie. A bald, muscular brute in a tacky denim vest and wielding a shotgun steps out from behind the crooked crane. You hate being told what to do. You almost shoot Mike while the gun is fixed on him, but you can see the pure terror and surprise on Mike's face. He didn't set you up. The accomplices in these ambushes are always so proud to have gotten you, but that doesn't last long. In the past, you've used Trance on your opponents, turning them all against one another. It's always amusing when you force the accomplice to strangle the mercenary who recruited him. You nod at Mike, and he gets your signal, fleeing with the powerful seeds you've sold him. He was right. You are an angel. But even an angel has to put her halo down from time to time. You turn your attention to the tacky brute, and you wonder how you'll make him kill himself. A bullet to the head is too easy.
You probably shouldn't let someone run off with the drugs you're hunting me down for, you say, eyeing the bag of cash from your transaction.
You'll go home with the bag and whatever money is in this clown's pocket, if anything.
We don't care about your drugs, the brute says.
2 more figures file in from your left, where Mike ran away. One is a woman, pretty if you're into faces with less personality than a mannequin's, and slender enough that breaking her arm should be easy. The other is a young man in a black lab coat with a face in desperate need of a mask, swollen nose, black eye, receding hairline.
Let me guess, you work for Pierce.
Only power-hungry junkies hopped up on brawn would be bold enough to take you on weaponless.
We know you kidnapped Franklin, the wannabe scientist says. You cringe. You've always hated the name Franklin. Where is he? The girl asks. She looks to be in her early 20s. She's likely the victim of many poor life choices, but stepping into the arena with you will be the one she loses her life over. He's gone forever, you happily report. You don't kill, the girl says. Oh, I kill. I just don't get blood on my hands. This confuses them. You're sure they're picturing the manner in which you killed their boss. You take advantage by dashing left, hiding behind a collapsed dumpster piled high with stained planks. 4 bullets sail past you. You wonder how long those bullets will fly before they drop and sink through the ocean. You pop out for a moment, wasting another bullet from the brute, who's not only a tacky dresser but also a terrible shot, and you dive out from the other end of the dumpster, rolling onto your back and taking cover inside a high stack of construction beams. You crawl your way around the beams, a lot like the days of high school when you would flee underneath the bleachers to hide from your bullies. Except now, those who are out to get you aren't teasing you for the scars on your face. The 3 of them are wondering if they stand a fighting chance against you. You slide out the mini blowgun from your boot and insert 2 more trance seeds. This is your favorite part. You take aim as they all group together. You blow the steel pipe 3 times, each seed finding its home in the neck of your enemies. You crawl out from underneath the beams like a sniper bold enough for a fistfight as the 3 of them wince in pain and realize what's about to happen to them. The brute points his gun at you, and you point your finger at him. You don't want to pull that trigger, you say, and he doesn't. Go back to base or wherever the hell you came from and kill everyone in their sleep. When you're done, tie concrete blocks around your ankles and go for a swim in the ocean.
Don't do it,
the girl shouts, holding the brute back, but he knocks her to the ground with a simple push, sending her rolling twice, and walks off. The wannabe scientist stands there, helpless. He knows if he runs, you'll tell him to stop. Maybe the stories have trickled down to him, too, that you made others cut their legs off for challenging you to a fight and then running away. Trying to run away, at least. Brute, wait! The brute stops. Give me your wallet. The brute tosses you his wallet. There's nothing inside. You knew it. Carry on. The brute walks off to go kill anyone looking for their poor leader who should have never gotten in your way. Please, the wannabe scientist cautiously approaches you. I just wanted to find my friend. Have mercy. Mercy. The client called you an angel. All these people after you, confusing you for the devil herself, and he saw the good in you. A little mercy can't hurt. Fine. You hate each other, you say, reprogramming any alliance they previously held. You want to beat each other to death. You watch the switch in their eyes, once fearful of you, now monsters to each other. You sit on a barrel, legs dangling, watching the fight. The girl finds a pipe and, well, it turns out a little mercy can hurt. A lot. The wannabe scientist is dead within minutes. The girl looks at you, bloodied from the few punches her victim managed to land on her, and awaits instruction from you. Finish what he was too weak to do. The girl loses the fight against her own pipe in less than a minute. That was fun. You finally collect your bag of money, which is unquestionably heavy, but it's nothing you can't handle considering you've thrown around heavier things. And people. You make your way to Carl, looking around to be certain you're not being followed, and you stop in your tracks when you see a familiar face. Your old assistant. His shoes are untied, and he smells of piss and other nastiness.
Slate is not to be betrayed. Slate is not to be betrayed,
he chants, walking past you with dead eyes. A dose of retrieve could save him, could give him his life back. But you don't carry that vaccine around, and you've already shown mercy once tonight. You rush to Carl, putting the chants behind you as you cross empty streets and tap on the passenger's window of the Ford truck he's in. Carl unlocks the door, and you jump in, throwing the money in the back seat.
I heard gunshots,
Carl says, scanning your body up and down. I didn't shoot anyone, you say. You're not lying. Or get shot.
I'm happy you're okay.
Carl smiles at you, and although your client's smile a few minutes ago was pathetic, that one felt more real. You know Carl doesn't approve of your business, but he continues to love